I'm Gab. He's not Jules. That's right, because Jules is away on the slopes, as you do in February, if you're French. It's Don Hutchinson. Yay. How about that? Don, psyched to have you on board because we've got the Champions League, which is back. We're going to look at some of the first legs. We're going to look at Inter and Liverpool. We're going to talk about Bayern. A bit of a scare there. We're going to talk about Atletico losing, about United winning. But we got to start. And this is what Jules would have wanted.
What the massive head of Jules after the PSG victory.
We got to start. Paris Saint-Germain and Real Madrid. And to help us sort that, how about Sid Lowe? Sid, thanks for coming on board. Now,
pleasure.
The capsule story of this, the sort of the 15-second recap, is Real Madrid with a half-fit Benzema go to the Bernabeu, and Carlo Ancelotti, who is Italian, as you may have noticed, decides to go and says, all right, let's do some damage limitation here because Benzema's not fit. Let's defend. The plan almost works, although they get battered. Paris Saint-Germain create a whole bunch of chances. They miss a penalty with Lionel Messi. And then at the end, they get punished, which is right and fair, because if you don't go and you don't try, then God punishes you by unleashing the fury of Mbappe. Is that fair?
Well, Carlo Ancelotti would say no. And he was asked almost this exact question post-game.
Even the God bit. Even the fact that it's divine retribution.
Well, I mean, Ancelotti, I don't know about Ancelotti's religious and spiritual beliefs, but I know about his footballing beliefs, which are always pragmatic. And I don't think they are especially defensive. But in terms of this particular game, he was asked this exact question about the approach from Real Madrid, whether they were too defensive, whether they ceded too much territory and possession, too much of the ball to Paris Saint-Germain, and that whether they had effectively gone there to just try and defend and eventually got caught for it. His answer, in a way, opens another question, which is this actually worse? Because his answer was no. It wasn't that we planned to do this. It was that we were unable to do anything else. He said, we couldn't bring the ball out. We gave the ball away too easily. We couldn't overcome their pressure. They had too much of the possession and we didn't play well. But it wasn't because we had planned it this way as a defensive approach, which I suppose is borne out, by the way, in the starting 11. Because he went 4-3-3 when we wondered whether he might put an extra midfielder in, whether he might play Fede Valverde nominally in the front three, but actually moving into midfield to try and protect that side of the pitch where, of course, Mbappe ran into Carvajal time and time again. And so, as I say, that asks another question, which is this more worrying? Not so much that Madrid planned to do this, but that they were actually incapable of playing any other way.
Well, with that in mind, Don, should we maybe give a little bit of credit to the sometimes maligned Paris Saint-Germain midfield, where none of those guys are named Kylian or Lionel.
Yeah.
But I thought on this day, they went out and they took the game to Real Madrid. And you can make the point that, sure, there was a threat and so on, and Benzema wasn't fit. But they went. They worked their rear ends off. They and they stood up to Kroos and Modric can keep the ball all day long, generally, if they want to. They weren't able to in this game.
No, I thought Paredes played really well. Danilo got around the place. Verratti was a star of the show because we know how silky and how good he is and technically outstanding. I just thought, when I seen the teams come in, you look at the Real Madrid team on paper and you think, strong midfield. And I was watching Karim Benzema and he was trying to ease himself into the game because he wasn't 100% fit. And I was watching Luka Modric and they were all passing a little bit sideways. They were a little bit afraid to either turn PSG around and hit a channel ball because they were afraid of maybe Benzema's hamstring going. So they tried to eke him into the game and work balls into his feet where he got a bit of self-confidence. But it was the left-hand side of PSG that done the damage. And I felt for Carvajal because the player that was in front of him in the midfield that was meant to double up and help him was Luka Modric. Now, he cannot and he will not in 100 million years try and get anywhere near Kylian Mbappe. And it was one of them games where you're watching it and you're thinking, if only 10 years ago, if only Isco had been fit and sharper, if only Bale, if only Eden Hazard from 5 years ago had been fitter, they might have been an option, but not in current form. If Ancelotti's looking to the bench, he's thinking, nope.
On the Paris Saint-Germain end, obviously this is a story that dominates everybody and we're about the hype and the big stars. So quickly on Lionel Messi's penalty, it did not look like a good penalty. Courtois had saved one before, I believe, in the Spanish Super Cup. Was it like 2013 or something? See how good I am? No, I just heard the guy say it in commentary. I'm like, oh, I'll repeat it to appear clever. Were you surprised? You've seen, I'm assuming you've probably seen Messi take more than 100 penalties. He's not infallible. But what was he trying to do there?
To answer the question, were you surprised? No. In fact, I was sitting in the stadium and said to the person sitting next to me, he misses this. And now it's easy to be a smart ass and say that. And then
because you don't tell us about the other 99 times that you
exactly,
say that.
Exactly that. Exactly yeah. that. It's very easy to say that. And then if he does score, just keep your mouth shut. I go, oh, well, there you go then. But I think there is a combination of things. One is that for a man who is exceptionally good at just about everything else, it's remarkable how, I wouldn't say how bad, but how normal Messi is from the penalty spot. Number two, the performance of Courtois over the last 18 months have been consistently brilliant. And it was again in this game. The save that he makes from Mbappe low down to his right, for example, is a brilliant save. And sitting there in the stands, and I realise that this is impressionistic, but he just looked huge. It just looks, he looks too big. He's bigger than the goal.
It's those like spider arms and legs. Yeah. You know, like I think his parents were volleyball players. And like he was built for that. And he just kind of extends. And Sid, I do have your confirmation on this. For a while, I thought, oh, Courtois, Oblak, Ter Stegen. La Liga has, you know, arguably the best threesome of goalkeepers in the world. But now it's kind of like, Courtois is still awesome. Oblak has gone backwards, and I think Ter Stegen too, right? Just as an aside, nothing to do with this game.
Yeah, it's not even close.
Okay.
Courtois is so far ahead of the other two at the moment.
All right, that settles that. So let's move on to...
Well, is that their decliner, though, or the improvement of Courtois?
It's both things. I think it's the improvement of Courtois, who is just extraordinary at the moment. I think it's also the decline of the other two. And the weird thing is, I think you look at the other two, and you can't say they've suddenly turned terrible. They've just stopped being miraculous.
Oblak this season's had some really, really poor games.
But I think you look at Oblak and he has poor games in terms of a, if you like, a broad analysis of him, rather than in terms of, look, there's a terrible mistake, there's a terrible mistake, there's a terrible mistake. You go back over this season and you won't actually find many really horrific errors from Oblak. What you just won't find is many saves, basically.
Yeah. All right, we need to move it back because this is my fascination because Jan Oblak was, well, still is. I mean, a tremendous keeper, one of my favorite keepers. And it was just an excuse for me to point out the weird thing that in, we call him Jan Oblak, which is, I think, moderately accurate to description of his name. But so many people in Spain love referring to him as Jan Oblak.
Oh.
So, who I always kind of assume was like a different person. Yeah. And if you're looking at Sid's reaction, like he's probably wondering, like, what's wrong with calling him Jan Oblak?
I have no idea what you're talking about. Is actually what the reaction is.
All right, there's an obvious Mbappe storyline here. You still get noises that he's not going to Real Madrid. You still get noises. I mean, Jules, every week he's here, he's like, well, you know, he has a contract in front of him if he wants to stay at Paris Saint-Germain. Today, there's reports saying, ooh, Liverpool could be in for him, which sounds to me like one of those...
Newcastle?
Stop it with the Newcastle. It sounds like one of those, you know, extraordinary things because, like, yeah, having just, you know, I've got Salah, I've got Mane, I need to figure out whether I'm going to extend them and stuff. I've signed Diaz, but whatever. Can you just talk a little bit about how that was lived in Spain, because I think it's fair to say that there's a sense of entitlement at Real Madrid and among Real Madrid fans. If you're going to lose this way, better that it's Mbappe that does it to you than Lionel Messi, right?
Absolutely. And genuinely, there's been something slightly strange in the reaction to this defeat in that there's almost been a celebration of defeat, which is something you don't see with Real Madrid. Now, I think celebration is a step too far, and that's why I use the word almost. But I think there was a degree of consolation and comfort and excitement in the fact that they were beaten by Mbappe and the way that they were beaten by Mbappe, because there is a reaction that kind of says, well, look, if this goal means we're not going to win the Champions League this year, that player means we will in the future because he's coming. And there's no doubt in Spain that he's coming. Now, I'm not saying he is. I'm saying that there's an assumption, which is not really challenged by anyone in Spain, that Mbappe will be at Real Madrid next season. And so that does change the reaction to this. I think we'd have seen a very, very, very different response if it had been 1-0 to Paris Saint-Germain and Messi had scored that goal, not Mbappe. So this is almost something to take kind of joy and celebration from a Real Madrid point of view.
The one of the sidelines of the response, and this always gets because it's almost like it's predictable. Because with Florentino Perez, you know, we're used to reactions. And he doesn't speak out that often, but there's always a sense, correct me if I'm wrong here, Sid, that he has minions who speak for him. And so
he doesn't need to speak himself.
Exactly. Now, sometimes these minions may be closer or further away from him. Sometimes maybe they don't actually reflect what Florentino says, because he didn't say this, but sometimes they speak out. But there have been stories that he's so upset and so disappointed by this defeat that he's decided to go and can Carlo at the end of the season and get Pochettino. Now, we talked about this on the FC show last night. I want to get Sid's reaction and your reaction. I think it's impossible to view this without the context of Manchester United, because we've had stories all, you know, last week about United senior pros supposedly wanting Pochettino.
Yeah.
And as I went, I'm not going to go on about this too much, but ask yourself, who are the senior pros who United should listen to at this club? Meaning not the guys like Paul Bencristiano who are leaving, or the guys like Varane who've just arrived. Who are they? Because I think on paper there's maybe, what, two guys who fit that bill?
Should anyone?
One of them is Maguire. Should you listen to whatever. But that's another thing. So, Sid, can you say, first of all, Sid, the plausibility of this, that Florentino sitting in the stands afterwards says, like, screw this. Like, let's get rid of Carlo. I want Pochettino.
The plausibility of it is very high in the moment. In the moment. I mean, you think, what's this? That's rubbish. let's try someone else. But there's a difference between what the reaction is. And this is like football fans in the stands when Florentino, I think one of the things that's sometimes forgotten about him, he's an ultra. He's very kind of well-mannered, smart-suited exterior disguises the way that he is. And so an immediate reaction that says that, yes. An actual plan to do that is a very different thing. Now, obviously, and Ancelotti knew this when he took over. He always knew that there will come a time when he gets sacked. And until then, fine. And Madrid were happy with him 2 weeks ago. And if they're not happy with him now, well, then, of course, that's because results are sliding. That's because there is a sense that they didn't play well in this game, that they were completely outplayed. But there's still a second leg to come. There's still a long way to go till the end of the season. So this idea that this is the decision taken now, I don't buy it. I buy that this is a comment that he made.
Right.
I've had enough of this. But not a decision that's taken now. The other thing is, to put this in its context, is that there was always an idea that Ancelotti was kind of a happy coincidence, him turning up at Real Madrid. A chance conversation is what ends up with him at Real Madrid to fill a short-term problem. And at some point, Real Madrid would be looking at a different manager. That is true as well. So that's the context of this. As for Pochettino, well, of course, this is a guy who twice was in a position he thought or he hoped to go to Real Madrid. In at least one of those cases, his escape clause was too high for Real Madrid to agree to, and he'd only just signed it. And Real Madrid's reaction was, what a bloody idiot. He's the one that closed the door to come into this club. And so there wasn't a huge amount of, if you like, goodwill because of that.
So Pochettino had an escape clause from Real Madrid. Why on earth would you want that?
No. So
it's a release clause. Sorry, to get out of his contract.
A release clause to get out of his contract.
That's just thinking.
I can't remember the exact which moment we're talking about here, when the date is. But I think I'm right in saying that, having been not sure about renewing, it was presumably at Spurs, but I'm trying to think when the dates coincide. Having not been sure about renewing, and knowing Real Madrid were interested, and knowing that the best way to facilitate a potential move to Real Madrid was to not renew, he had them renewed, and Real Madrid looked at this as if to say, you absolute idiot. You know, if you just held on, we could have done this more easily.
Mm. Yeah, I love the idea, by the way, of Florentino as like an ultra beneath his suit, like sort of in his head, like sort of like humming, you know, going like Juanito Maravilla and whatever.
Off with his head.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Don, on the subject of Pochettino, I find this remarkable because I'm a huge Pochettino fan. I really think he's an exceptional manager. I also recognize he's not doing a good job in Paris in terms of week in, week out. He hasn't clicked.
Didn't win the league last season.
Yeah, and you know, this season they're going to win it. And you know, he took over halfway through the year last year, to be fair, but still. And I think, as Jules has told us many times, if Pochettino were to go away, Paris Saint-Germain wouldn't be too fast. If he were to go to Real Madrid, however, they would be like, oh, pay up the compensation.
Yeah.
And I can't see Real Madrid necessarily doing that. Could see United potentially doing that. Mm-hmm. But it's, where do you see Pochettino? I mean, when you look at this when you watch Paris Saint-Germain play, I mean, forget, obviously they were exceptional against Real Madrid.
Yeah.
But week in, week out, do they look like their team that where he's really having an impact?
I don't think they do, Gab. I don't think they do. And I think that's the riddle and that's the mystery of Pochettino. He's got an unbelievable CV in terms of his stock's high. But as I said, and you just said there, he came in halfway through the season last season but didn't win the league in Ligue 1, which is virtually impossible not to win the league. The big prize is always the Champions League. Many managers have gone and then failed. That's a fact, and it's one of the hardest dress rooms, I would imagine, to try and secure that Champions League. But his stock's still high. Man United seem to still want him. He's on the radar of Real Madrid. But he's got to start winning things. He's got to start winning the big prizes.
It's funny when you say unbelievable CV, and I get what you mean. And I think I mean
in terms of where he thinks or where we all sort of perceive him to be.
Yeah,
without winning the big trophies.
It's not. I mean, if Mourinho were to Zoom bomb our conversation, he would have been like, "Yeah, but what did Pochettino want?"
Exactly. Right? That's what
and
I mean.
You have a point,
of course.
Right? Sid, let's throw it forward to the return leg, because Real Madrid now will have some suspensions. Obviously, Ferland Mendy out as well. I assume Benzema will be better, but also Neymar, you would think, would be better. But it's still just a one goal difference. I mean, I think, what does your head tell you?
I don't know, is the answer to that. I think you're right. It is only a one goal difference. Obviously, the removal of the away goals rule means that it really is only a one goal difference. You're not in a position in which if Paris Saint-Germain catch you on the break, it's done. Because, you know, previously we'd have been in a position where you think, well, this is set up for Paris Saint-Germain to get them once. One breakaway of Neymar or Mbappe, boom, score a goal. All right, that's it. But it's not like that now. And so in a way, it's not massively different, I suppose, from it having been a 0-0 in the first game, in that Real Madrid would still feel the need that they were going to have to go and score a goal at some point. I think that the absence of Casemiro is a really interesting one, because Casemiro is the one player in the squad that doesn't really have a natural replacement. Now, you could see them maybe going for Kroos and Modric as a pair and putting two other midfielders in to try and balance it out. You could see them maybe going for Fede Valverde there, but it's just not his position. You could see them going with Camavinga there, but it's not really his position either. I mean, he could play that role, but it's not really his position. And so I think that provides a big question mark. The absence of Mondi, I think, means that you're likely to see Nacho at left back, who's solid and steady enough, but it's up against Mbappe. So, and if you've got Neymar on the other side, it's not like you can double up and try and protect him. And also the other thing is just looking at what happened in Paris, just how much better Paris Saint-Germain were. And all of that, of course, leads you to say, well, look, PSG should go through. But this is Real Madrid. And I must confess, and I'm going to be honest with you on this, throughout the game in Paris the other night, particularly when Paris Saint-Germain had those last two chances in the 85th and the 90th minute they didn't take, I thought to myself, this is Madrid in Europe all over. The most successful team in Europe is also the great survivors. And sometimes you don't know how they've done it, but somehow they're still standing. And when Mbappe scores, of course, that bursts that bubble a little bit, that bursts that narrative a little bit. But it's still only 1-0. And this is still a team that's still standing. And in recent years in the Champions League, maybe I shouldn't follow this, because after they went to Ajax, what was it, 4 years ago and won, or 3 years ago and won, I thought, oh, that's it, it's done. And Ajax came to the Bernabeu and absolutely took them to pieces. But there is a bit of me that thinks, it's Real Madrid at the Bernabeu. And that, you've asked me what my head says. And maybe that's not my head. Maybe that's an irrational way of looking at it. But you can't help but sort of lean that way.
I'm just going to throw this out there as a possibility. But if Benzema is fully fit, I wouldn't be surprised if he actually considers maybe changing and doing what some people suggested he might have done in this leg, and perhaps replace Casemiro, not with one guy, but with two guys, Valverde and Camavinga, with Modric and Kroos, dominate the possession and kind of leave Paris Saint-Germain in a situation where, you know, assuming Messi starts, you have Neymar and Messi who just kind of like hang out and contribute nothing, really try to grind them down, at least in the first half with the possession, a set piece, a piece of magic, a piece of creativity, creating something for Vinicius to run onto. And then if that doesn't work, then you can start thinking about, you know, Asensio, Isco, Rodrigo, whatever you want to do at that stage. And then obviously you need to gamble more. How would you play it?
My prediction before a ball was kicked was PSG win 1-0, as they did, but Real Madrid go through 2-1 on aggregate. That's how I saw it, because I still look at the PSG players and I still think, on your worst day, have you got the players that will do the dirty work in the second leg when the going gets tough? If it does get tough, if Real Madrid dominate, I personally, in my opinion, I'd put Luka Modric in one and I'd play him as the holding midfield player and I'd just replace him with Valverde in Modric's position. And then Luka Modric has got the eyes, he's got the expertise, he's got the intelligence and know-how to play that position. He's a player that can play any position. Left back might be a bit more of a problem. Alaba could maybe shift over one and bring a centre-back in to play alongside Militao. But they've got to start well. And in the Bernabeu, would it really shock you if Real Madrid went through? It wouldn't shock me. Would it shock you if PSG, some of their fancy players and some of the players that don't want to put the hard yards in when the going gets tough, if they don't do that, would it shock you? It wouldn't shock me. At the same time, if Neymar turns it on with a bit of magic, if Mbappe turns it on with a bit of magic, it's wide open, is what I'm saying. I don't think this is done.
Yeah, I agree with you there. It could get ugly very quickly if they turn it on. Sid, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/gab. Just go to Indeed.com/gab right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/gab. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Don, let's talk Inter and Liverpool. Liverpool, 7 of 7 in the Champions League so far. Ajax, of course, play next week. They can also be 7 of 7. Mm-hmm. Bayern were perfect, of course, and they were held by Salzburg. Were you impressed? 2-0 win at the San Siro. We're more impressed by the result, the performance, because the we're kind of getting two different narrative in Italy. Is like, wow, we didn't expect Inter to play so well. Mm. And then last night, you and I were on the FC show.
Yep.
Stevie Nicol, not impressed at all by Inter, and thought it was pretty easy and straightforward.
I thought Inter played well. I thought between both boxes, I thought they were fantastic. I thought their setup was a problem for Liverpool. When Jurgen Klopp plays 4-3-3, it was a stretch for Harvey Elliott, for Thiago to try and get out to the wing-backs. I thought Dumfries and Perisic were excellent. I think the majority of play, as I said, between the boxes came from Inter. Granted, they never really looked like scoring. They rattled the crossbar and Dzeko had sort of one or two little opportunities, but Konate was excellent. Van Dijk got voted man of the match. It tells you how much or a defensive display it was from Liverpool. And then what happened was they grew into the game. They got the goal from Firmino and then all of a sudden Jurgen Klopp went with experience and know-how. Jordan Henderson came on. Luis Diaz, I thought, was direct. He was like an animal. He was getting the ball. He was just taking players on. He was taking Inter all the way back. And then you could see, I think, the gulf in class in the end. But I think for large parts, watching that game, I thought Liverpool were under stress and defending at times very, very deeply and found it really uncomfortable to play in San Siro.
Yeah, I mean, I think both things can be true. You can say Liverpool deserved to win because they got the goals.
Yep.
I also haven't seen Inter play like this season. And it seems silly. And I know that the Muppet Show is going to come out like, oh, well, what does it say about Inter? If, you know, this is their best game of the season and they still lose at home 2-0. Ha, ha, ha. You know, but no, actually, Inter played many different ways this season. I did not think that they could go out, match Liverpool for intensity.
Yeah.
Those switches between the fullbacks, which Van Dijk after the game said, you know, they were switching the ball, which is kind of like what Liverpool's supposed to do, what they do so effectively. And Klopp touched upon this too, and they were creating one-on-ones in wide areas with the fullbacks.
Yeah.
So I think Inter showed that they can play like this. Now, obviously, they need to finish better. There's other chances where, you know, the Perisic one where he blows through on the left and he puts the ball, he just maybe hits it too hard or, you know, doesn't find Lautaro. Maybe Lautaro should have done better there.
Yeah.
The Konate one that you mentioned where I thought he did a great job on Dzeko. There was a lot of little chances like that, which I think could have turned the game for Inter.
But there was lots of half chances for Inter.
Yeah.
It was like they were one pass away from scoring or really creating an unbelievable chance. There were so many bits where you're watching going, Konate had to defend there, Van Dijk had to defend there.
But I also thought they were so courageous as well in the way they played. They looked so confident. They don't normally, even in Serie A, when, you know, sometimes they raise the intensity, sometimes they beat you in other different ways. I hadn't seen this side. It's almost as if Simone Inzaghi said, we need to play this way in Europe against Liverpool to have success, because if we play at a slower pace or whatever, it's not going to work. You know, we're not gifted enough to do that.
Yeah.
And they bought into it. And I think they come out of this really, really emboldened, really strengthened.
Same.
And for those who forget, by the way, and I know it's, oh, look, the San Siro champions of Italy, oh, this is all you got and all this stuff. Lest we forget, Inter lost their manager in the summer, who, you know, people thought was the architect of everything, and in many ways he was.
Yeah.
They lost their best player, Lukaku. Their second best player, Nicolò Barella, was injured for this game, and the third best player, he was suspended.
Yeah.
And the third best player, Achraf Hakimi, now plays for Paris Saint-Germain.
Yeah,
take three guys out of a well-drilled unit, and you are basically rebuilding from scratch.
Of course.
And that's what they did.
And you're playing against the mighty Liverpool. So there was lots of contradictions after the game where people are going, oh, if Inter played so well, how come they didn't score? How come they didn't trouble a goalkeeper? How come they had no shots on target? Well, you can still play well in the game. You can still dominate the ball and cause Liverpool problems and cause big teams problems.
I had about this whole shots on target stat, because obviously Firmino's goal was the first shot on target.
Yeah, 75 minutes.
Sometimes statistics are relevant. Sometimes you have to put them in context.
Mm.
Somebody, and I'll reveal who it is in a minute, but he's from Newcastle and has scored a couple goals in his career. He always thought this whole thing about getting the ball on target is the worst thing you can tell a striker when you're shooting on goal.
Right.
Because if you think about getting the ball on target, you're going to hit it to the middle of the goal or where the keeper can get it.
Yeah.
You don't want... So it's a terrible metric to judge.
Mm.
And the person who told me this was Mr. Alan Shearer, who I think knows a thing or two about scoring
just a
goals.
Little bit, you know. Just a little bit.
So,
and if you hit the crossbar or the framework, that doesn't count as being on target.
No, so let's pretend that never happened.
Yeah, dear.
I was struck by what Van Dijk said afterwards, where he said, before the game, Klopp told us, you know, we have to know how to suffer. And I'm wondering, and he said, then we did suffer in this game.
Yep.
I'm wondering, though, between the Burnley game and it was rainy and messy and Brownhill and all the bad stuff that comes when you go to Turf Moor, which Liverpool gutted out and won, between the Leicester game where they won 2-0, I'm wondering, like, are we seeing a slightly different dimension of Liverpool here where they're winning ugly in a way that, you know, before they were winning brilliantly.
Yeah.
But it's a strength, isn't it, for Liverpool?
Absolutely. Of course it's a strength. You can go to San Siro and keep a clean sheet and suffer and come away with two goals. It's incredible. And you go to Burnley, horrible, windy, driving, diagonal rain where you're freezing cold, and you go there and you win. And I think the difference from Liverpool from probably the start of the season, where they were quite licky, they were quite giving up a lot of goals and a lot of chances, now they've really tightened up, in my opinion. I think they've got really confident at the back. There was always this little feeling where you can get at Liverpool. You can get one or two chances. I think now with Van Dijk being back to his best, it took him a little bit of time. And Konate, Matip, whoever you like, whichever partnership you like, and you've got Trent and Robbo, you've got Fabinho, one of the best holding midfield players in Europe. They're a strong side.
I want you to take me into the footballer mindset here. Now, you were more of a midfielder than a fleet-footed forward winger type, but I got to go back to that moment.
It's complimenting in there somewhere.
but I have to go to that moment where... And this is one of the, and you could say it should have been one of the half chances Inter had, where Inter break and Lautaro Martinez is on the center right and he's alone with Virgil van Dijk in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there watching it and I say, okay, coaching 101, you got no help, nobody's coming, there's nobody, obviously, you know, people are running back, but Liverpool will have as many numbers back as Inter. Nobody, you know, Mbappe's not on his way, right? You know, it's still Dzeko trundling through, maybe Çalhanoğlu. Take him on. Take on Van Dijk. Because two out of three outcomes are okay. Either you beat him and you shoot on goal.
Yeah.
Or most likely, or you get fouled, right? Which is, sorry, three out of four outcomes. Or you get fouled. Or you lose the ball, but it rolls away. And then maybe, you know, you've got a runner coming in and you can get win the second ball.
Mm-hmm.
Or otherwise he wins it cleanly, which would suck, obviously, right?
Yeah.
But it's really difficult for a defender to do, right? Most likely, for a defender to win it cleanly in a one-on-one situation like that is extremely difficult, right? And he doesn't. And he stops. And he freezes. And Van Dijk just looks so confident in front of him. And I take your point that Van Dijk's got pace. But you know what? So does Lautaro. And at that stage where they were on the pitch, it's not so much recovery pace over 20, 30 yards where the taller player, you know, is going to win out.
Yeah.
It's first step. Are we blaming Lautaro? Are we just going to praise? Did Van Dijk put some kind of voodoo hex on him?
No, it was a case of Lautaro when he was trying to take him on centrally. And I loved the way Van Dijk went ultra slow. And he just said, go on, knock it into that channel because I'm going to beat you. And I'm going to take the ball off you. And I think Lautaro was thinking in the back of his mind, yeah, that's exactly what's going to happen. You're going to make me look like a mug here because I'm not quicker than you. In a 1v1, he's probably not going to beat him. Yes, you can. You can produce a little bit of magic and take him on. But I think that's 2 or 3 times out of 10. I think Van Dijk was in total control of the situation. The best he got out of it, actually, was when he did wait for reinforcements. He chopped inside and Thiago nicked it off him and knocked it for a corner, and Inter got a corner out of the situation. But I never felt as though Lautaro could ever take Van Dijk on a 1v1.
It's interesting because this is where analytics comes into it. If, let's say you're right, if you do have a 2 or 3 chances out of 10, right?
Yep.
Say 25% chance of Lautaro beating Van Dijk.
Yep.
25% chance. If you beat Van Dijk, you then have an 80% chance to score from where you are on the pitch, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Which, if you multiply 25 times 80, right? 0.25 times 0.8, if my math is correct.
My math is not good.
You have a 0.2 chance of scoring, right? If you put those two things together.
But then where does Alisson come into it as well?
Well, no, so I would say...
So Lautaro in that moment has got to beat Virgil van Dijk and Alisson.
Well, presumably if he beats van Dijk, Alisson's coming out of his goal. As great as Alisson is...
So the numbers are coming down, is what I'm saying. And I think Lautaro knew
I don't think they come down to much more than 80%. I expect a striker shooting from there against a goalkeeper, even Alisson, coming off his goal, you expect him to score every time. I say 80%, I think, is a fair assessment from there, right? That's what the XG says when it's one-on-one with the keeper, right?
Yeah.
So if you put those two things together, that should have been a really big chance, much higher than what you would get from the corner.
I don't see it. I don't see how XG, and I don't see how that measures up to something that you can never manage or sort of measure, which is confidence. Because Lautaro on the ball.
But I'm saying that's the difference, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the confidence,
yeah,
right? That's what changes the whole thing.
Of course.
The combination of Van Dijk's confidence and maybe Lautaro's lack of confidence leads to Lautaro making a bad decision.
Yep.
To me, that is phenomenal defending from Van Dijk,
yep,
mental as well as physical.
You have that though, Gab. You have that when you come up against 1v1. I'm pretty sure if Joel Matip had been in that scenario, 1v1, Lautaro would have tried to take him on. He would have.
Which is curious to me because I would assume that Matip would have a quicker first step than Van Dijk.
Yes, but overall...
And a quicker change of direction. Overall, obviously you take Van Dijk.
That's it, yeah.
I want to ask you about another choice that I love Harvey Elliott. I love that. I was so happy when he came back. Part of my fascination with Jurgen Klopp is I'm old enough to remember Harvey Elliott when he was a winger at Fulham, which is because that was only, what, like 18 months ago?
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, look, this guy, you know, he's an attacking midfielder. He's got the skills. Maybe he would be a 10, but he plays wide in 4-3-3. Maybe he can force his way into the front three rotation as an alternative. And then the season begins. Wijnaldum leaves. Season begins. He's got injuries. He plays Elliott in the midfield three.
Yeah.
Elliott comes back from injury, and the dude is still in the midfield three. Can you talk a bit about that, about playing as the third midfielder in a Klopp system versus playing as a winger in a Klopp system, how the things are different, how they're similar. And maybe also that maybe we, when we look at young players, we shouldn't be so obsessed with defining them. He's an 8, he's a 6, he's a 7, because it's still football, right? And these are still unformed.
Yeah, define him as his career is going to be incredible because he's a brilliant player. But when you simplify it and you go, right, where does Mo Salah play? Where's he effective? Where would Harvey Elliott be 18 months ago? Is 1v1s with defenders. If you're a midfield player, you bang it into Mo Salah, you bang it into Mane or Diaz or Javier, if they're playing as wingers, they can take players on. There's an end product. When you step back and you go into the midfield and you go into that engine room where literally every time you get hold of the ball, there's players around you and you're in San Siro and you're outnumbered in midfield. They had 5v3, so you had no real area to try and work in. He's under pressure. Everything gets a little bit clogged. By the way, he's making his debut in the Champions League.
Yeah, no.
It's incredible.
It's a phenomenal vote of confidence.
It's phenomenal.
But I'm saying that we've seen him play there before. Like,
My thought process before the game when I seen the team sheets come in was, that's a gamble from Jurgen Klopp. And at some point, you've got to put Javier Elliott in because you've got to know and you've got to test and you've got to see if he can handle the environment, which he did. But it was a gamble because I thought, Jordan Henderson on the bench, Naby Keita on the bench, guys that have got so much know-how experience, I thought it was a gamble. But he'll be better for it. So it's one of them where you come out the game, if you're Harvey Elliott and you're Jurgen Klopp, and you step back and you come away from it and you watch your analysis and you have your own mental thoughts how the game went. Man, that was a tough game. I played against three in midfield. I hardly got the ball, and when I did, I was under pressure. It's hard. Game's hard.
I'm just fascinated by it. I mean, did you always play midfield from the time you were
there? No. I played as a centre forward, played as a centre back, played as a central midfield player, played at right back. You can learn positions. Football's not the hardest job in the world. If you can solve one or two problems and realise who you're playing against, if you're clever, you'll succeed.
What I find interesting is in central midfield, there's very few opportunities to dribble past opponents or take
traffic
one on one, right? Because because of
traffic.
And often, even if you do, there's another dude right there.
That's
so
what I'm
what's
saying.
The point, right?
Yeah.
I'm assuming if Elliott played as a winger coming through, it's because he has acceleration and he has the one on one trickery.
Yeah.
So conventional wisdom to me would say, well, if you play him in midfield, you lose that side of his game, right? Mm-hmm. And this is, but then Klopp sees that and he says, well, you can be so much more. You still have that because you don't lose that. But
and if you could wriggle away from one.
And you wriggle away, yeah. Occasionally, you'll have that, right?
You're away, yeah.
Naby Keita has that, for example.
Exactly.
Doesn't often show it, but he has it.
Yeah.
That's what I find interesting. And that's what, you know, I can't think of too many occasions, and I'm sure there's people out there, and if you're on social media, let me know, where you've taken a player who was considered to be a phenom in one role at a very young age, and you've moved him to a very different one in central midfield.
Yeah.
Because what you said, the football's not the hardest, all the same.
Yeah.
Yeah, fine, but you know, you're tall, like you're a viable, so, you know, center backs in all shapes and sizes.
Mm.
I don't think you would have ever played as a winger.
No.
Right? For example, so making that type of transition, I can't think of other players in recent years.
Actually,
at big clubs.
Weirdly, I did play as a winger at Sunderland and had my best ever productivity. Scored close to 15 goals a season because I never had a trick. I wasn't quick, but I had a good brain and I could see things. I could see opportunities. I had good vision. So you work off the players that you're playing around. If you take Man City, for example, don't play with any strikers. It's a brilliant debate and it'll go on forever.
Right.
And who's right, who's wrong. But you drop Kevin De Bruyne into a deeper role. You drop Bernardo Silva into a deeper role. Phil Foden plays as a false nine.
Who was your manager when you played as a winger?
It was Peter Reid.
Did he just do it because he wanted to shoehorn you into the lineup?
No, he had a way of playing. He had and I'll say this without being arrogant, he had two guys who were clever. And he had Julio Arca, who played on the left-hand side, a very, very good technician. And I played on the right-hand side. He had Kevin Phillips and Niall Quinn through the middle. So all my role was is when the ball goes up to Niall Quinn, where can you be? Can you be intelligent enough to find a bit of space? I could never take anyone. I never really had a trick. Didn't have any pace. But you find good positions.
So who was delivering the crosses from your side?
It would have been from fullbacks. It would have been Michael Gray down the left-hand side. It would have been Julio Walker down the left-hand side. I would have been more inverted because I couldn't take players on,
right,
which then causes a problem for the left-back. Can your right-back, Chrissy Maitland at the time, get on the overload and get on the overlap? So there's different ways of playing, but you've got to be... I think as a footballer, you've got to be able to problem solve. If you're a good problem solver on the pitch, I'll tell you one nightmare I had very quickly. Graeme Souness saw me as a right back. And he said to me, I don't see you as a midfield player. He said, I see you as a right back. This is one for the oldies. And he said to me, I'm going to play you against Nottingham Forest in the reserves this week. And if you play well, you're going to play for Liverpool's first team. He put me up against Franz Carr. Don't know if you ever remember Franz Carr. Lightning. One of the quickest players you've ever seen in your life. Roasted me. I didn't know how to play the game. Now, if I'm playing against Franz Carr, send him into midfield, send him into traffic. I didn't. I tried to deal with him 1v1 and got roasted. And Graeme Souness come down and went, you're not a right back. And I went, No. But 5 years on,
How many 6'1 right backs are there? Not many.
No, but the point of the story is, the moral of the story is, if you say to me in 5 years' time,
you can make up for it in other ways.
Because I send him into traffic. I don't go tight with Franz Carr. And that's what footballers can do. If you problem solve, you can do it. And that's what Harvey Elliott, and that's what all these young kids
do. So if you're playing right back against Mbappe, you just play him inside and then problem solved.
You sort of overload and you compensate and go, yeah, go into there, please. I want nothing to do with you. Exactly. That's exactly what you do.
You're Andrew Militao's problem now.
Of course
now.
You do. Carvajal, send him into Modric, nothing to do with me. Send him into Casemiro, nothing to do with me.
The 2024 NFL Draft heads to Detroit, and it's time to see who gets the job.
Caleb is a unique and special talent throwing the football.
And what sets them apart.
The Heisman Trophy winner is Jaden Daniels.
All of the greats were hired here.
What a throw by Mahomes.
See who gets the job.
Are you ready?
The 2024 NFL Draft begins Thursday, April 25th on ESPN, ABC, and NFL Network.
All right, enough Inter. How about some quick hits instead?
Do it.
Manchester City demolished Sporting 5-0 on the road. It was 4-0 at halftime, and Don, I am running out of things to say about them other than this, quote, recognized striker thing is nonsense. They need to stop saying this.
We need to stop saying it. I think everyone needs to have a T-shirt with I can't mention Man City's number nine or lack of ever again. They prove that they can take a player who's a right winger or a left winger and play him through the middle, and he's still a number nine. It's outrageous, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, they're so good.
And while you're at it, get rid of this false nine thing. Like, yes, false nine has to do with how a player moves.
Should we just call him a number 10?
Well, it depends. Foden, you can make a case that when he plays there, you know, he moves around a lot. But when Jack Grealish, the few games he played up front, he played as a centre forward, made centre forward runs.
Yeah, Bayern last night struggled against Salzburg. What's the story with Bayern? Why are they struggling?
First of all, this is pretty impressive because we need to give credit to Salzburg, because despite having a 36-year-old left back who's actually older than both managers, I think it's the first time in the history of the Champions League that this has happened. And despite Salzburg losing Noah Okafor, arguably their second or third best player early in this game, they just gave up so many chances on the counter. This is a team that I think was a bit imbalanced. This comes on the back of the Bochum game.
Yeah,
against Bochum, I don't know what Nagelsmann was thinking. He decides he's going to play a back three and then Joshua Kimmich on his own in front to shield them. That didn't work. He had two central midfielders in this game, but still they got through. I think there's issues at the back. I think the absence of Manuel Neuer obviously doesn't help
and
them
he's
either.
Still playing Zula, who's on the move.
Yeah, but he needs to play somebody, right? Yeah. I don't. People have said, "Oh, but Pavard and Lucas Hernandez," Joel says this all the time, are center backs who play fullback. So they should have the quickness to deal with it. They couldn't deal with this. You know, Süle at 6'7" or however tall he is, you don't expect him one-on-one against 50 people. But he needs shielding. He needs protection. It's unfair, I think, to totally blame him. But still, the draw probably means they're going to get through. Manchester United beat Brighton 2-0. Cristiano Ronaldo is back scoring again. The mini drought is over. Don, is the glass half full again at Old Trafford?
I think it's okay to say, Gab, no one's got an idea. No one's got a clue what is going on at Man United in terms of how do you get a handle on their performances. How can they? If you go back to last season, that was a bit of a riddle where they kept going behind in games, especially away from home, and winning. So the confidence was there. There was still that mini little DNA. Oh, we've been here before, we can do it. Now their DNA is, oh, we'll score a goal, we'll bottle it. Teams will score against us, and we've got no idea.
But it didn't happen in this game.
No, it didn't happen in this game, but you know, Man United should be beating Brighton. Brighton are a good side. Graham Potter's a good manager, but this is Man United at Old Trafford.
And I think Brighton have been a bit stale of late.
Yeah,
so
you would have fancied.
Yeah, I mean, 3 points, but they're top four.
Right, Antonio Conte giving an interview to Sky Italia. Very negative.
Yeah, he seemed to complain about the January transfer. He said this bizarro thing where he's like, well, we're down numerically. It's not easy when, you know, you lose four players in January and only bring two players in. And he says four important players for us. So the four players who left in January and were Gio Lo Celso.
Didn't play.
Brian Hill. Didn't start a single game. Ndombele and Dele Alli, right?
Hardly played.
And you brought in Bentancur and Kulusevski. Now, leaving aside the fact that your mate, Fabio Paratici, is the director of football, and presumably he had you okayed these moves, right? Because it's not like people were beating down a door. It's not like, you know, Dele Alli was saying, I must leave now, you know. And I don't get why you would say that. Sure, you're down in numbers, but if you want to give explanations, mention the individual mistakes, mention the fact that Eric Dyer, who's actually pretty important for Spurs defensively, isn't there. There's a lot of other things. I think what he's doing is, this isn't a rerun of the past, because he's not stupid. He knows that Daniel Levy's not going to start signing big checks in the middle of the season, right? He's managing expectations. When he said there's a 1% chance of them making the Champions League, and he said this again before, he says, oh, well, you need experience, blah, blah, blah. I think he's saying it so that they look better when they get in the top four. He's not saying this to be manipulative of the ownership.
You don't think there's an ulterior motive? Maybe he's trying to buy a little bit of time for a team that's lost three on the spin. They've got Man City at the weekend. You don't think he's getting his ducks in the row?
He is, in terms of managing expectations.
Is he going to walk in the summer?
I don't think. No, because his reputation is not enhanced if he does that. Because he also said, look, I know that this is a different project. It's a different experience. We want to go with younger players. And again, every indication I have is that when he went in, he knew what he was getting into. Yep. So he's trying to manage expectations. It just comes out in a clunky way. When you say something in one country, you know it's going to get picked up again in other countries. Then it's not 1965 anymore. Yeah. Conte also, as I mentioned, bemoans the lack of experience, Don. And it struck me as kind of ironic on the day that you have Salzburg, the youngest team in the history of the Champions League knockouts, going out and playing so well. What's your view on this? Because there's a school of thought. I know, I personally think we in football continuously overvalue experience.
Yes.
I'm not saying it's not important, but it's overvalued. I would have thought from Conte's perspective, he's got younger, fitter, cheaper, faster, angrier players, and players who are hungrier and will do everything he tells them to, especially if you have a micromanaging coach rather than perhaps more of a pragmatist who says, like, I trust your judgment on the pitch.
Yeah.
Surely it's better to have younger players, no?
There's no substitute, though, for experience. I think if you go back to his Inter Milan team that won the title, that was pretty experienced.
Oh, he's always had experienced players. What I'm asking is, I would have thought he'd be better with... Obviously, quality is the biggest discriminator, right?
In an ideal world, you want a bit of both. You want a bit of legs, you want a bit of youth, you want someone that's hungry, you want someone that's fearless. That all ticks the boxes of young players. But when you're playing in games where the going gets tough, young kids don't know how to deal with it. I've been there myself. I've been in a Liverpool side with five or six youngsters, Steve McManaman, Robbie Fowler, Jamie Redknapp, Steve Harkness, Rob Jones and myself. And you're trying to compete with the Chelseas, the Arsenals, the class of 92, with all their experience and their youth. They had it best where they had a mixture. So I think for Conte, I think he'd like some young players that are coming through that are dynamic and he can work with them and he sees, yeah, he's fit, he's strong, he's fearless. At the same time, you want to rely on a little bit of know-how, and that sacrifice sometimes comes with a lack of legs.
I guess. I think Salzburg, though, are showing, I mean, from a team-building concept, and obviously this is the whole Red Bull machine and stuff, that if you go and you seek these guys out, and look, I mean, they pay for their players, right? They get prospects, they get promising players, right? Yeah. It's not like they go and get people off the street. You know, there's real value in that because these are players that then you can then resell, you can maintain. They tend to be more coachable. They tend to have less issues, less distractions. It's a tough one.
I'd like to see the numbers between young sides winning the big prizes and experienced sides.
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic, I think.
Yeah. Atletico Madrid, I mean, this is a team that's just gone from being ugly but brilliant, being horrible but brilliant. Now they're losing against Levante, bottom of the table, confidence shot to bits.
Yeah, Levante's bottom of the table, for instance, not Real Madrid, not Atletico Madrid. They're still level on points with Barcelona, right? So they're still in it. But yeah, this is a game where you expect 3 points because Levante aren't good, although they do have an Italian manager, which helped. They've only won one game all season. They managed just one shot on goal. They still managed to have these issues defensively, which Atletico never had before. And going forward, whether it's Correa or Cunha or Suarez or Griezmann, he hasn't found the right balance.
No.
Brendan Rodgers is under pressure at Leicester City, and so much so that earlier this week, there were reports that he had been sacked. Now, those rumors turned out to be unfounded. does this make sense to you, like, that Brendan Rodgers should be moving on?
No, doesn't make sense whatsoever. He's got to be given the time. I think he was quoted this week as saying some players here have been here too long. Some players at Leicester think they're better than what they actually are, which is good.
Who's he talking about? If you're speculating.
Well, if you're speculating, maybe Jamie Vardy. Okay. Been there for a long time. There's been many players at Leicester when you look
to
at...
To which I would say, well, there you've got Patson. That's why you bought Patson.
Exactly.
And you've got Iheanacho.
Yeah. So maybe players that have been in and around the squad that he thinks have been here too long, got too much of an opinion. Managers always fear experienced players when they've got an opinion.
See, I looked at this and I was wondering who he was talking about, right? But, you know, who would have that say in the dressing room, right? I mean, Amarty's been there for a long time, but I don't think Amarty's the problem, right?
Casper's been there for quite a while. He's got a big voice.
He's got a big... So I've been meeting, and I'm purely speculating here, Casper. Don't get angry with me. I'm not accusing you of anything. But, right, when you hear about this, yeah, you naturally gravitate towards Vardy, who's... But Vardy's, you know, it's coming towards the end of the road.
Doesn't it feel like Vardy would be a problem? Or Casper would be a problem?
Depends if he likes the manager.
Well, exactly.
Daniel Ranieri might disagree with you on that one.
Well, exactly. But that's the problem of managers. I've played for managers who like experience. They like players that can manage on the pitch. I look at Kasper Schmeichel being the skipper and I think you'll do well to replace him. That's not a problem I would have thought is Leicester's immediate problem.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, maybe we don't know what Brendan's thinking, but no. I personally think...
Give him time.
Which is the time. He's shown he can do it. The last 2 years weren't an illusion. They were real. And I know that Leicester spent a lot of money, but they've also had a tremendous amount of injuries. Mm. I think this season as well, Tielemans' contract situation hasn't helped.
No.
It seems like an odd one, unless there's something behind the scenes that we don't know.
He's dealing with a lot, isn't he? Brendan's trying to deal with a lot to try and get Leicester for where they think they want to be, who have just missed out on top four, two seasons on the spin with experienced players. Tielemans has gone ridiculously below his standards because the contract's up, I think, in 18 months' time, and he's nowhere near the player he was. So they've got to get going, otherwise they're going to finish way
And they've had injuries.
Yeah.
Because you have Fofana there the whole year. I think they have an extra 6 or 7 points on the table. That's just my view. It's a weird one.
Well, the answer to this question, I think I've got a feeling, Gab, is going to blow my mind. So this is UEFA have named Socios as their official fan token. What's a fan token?
Okay.
What is it?
So you might have seen this. People tie this in with blockchain and crypto and NFTs. And when you don't know what this is, But to make this very simple, Socios is a company that has been around a few years. They're based in Malta. They have deals with 53 different clubs, including some clubs in the Premier League. There are other clubs who are in that same space. So the concept behind fan tokens is pretty simple. Although you might say, well, why would I buy that?
Yeah.
So essentially, you as a fan, mm-hmm. you want to show your fandom.
Yeah.
So you buy a token. And these tokens are virtual tokens. It's almost, think of it as buying a share. But it's secured. It's secured by blockchain technology. It's effectively, it's non-fungible. So you buy this token, which you can then sell, you can keep. It's not a share in the sense that you don't get voting rights on the club board, but to incentivize fans to buy these things, you can vote on certain things decided by the club. So, for example, Arsenal are a good example of this. I think they allow fans to vote 6 times a year on things. They might be things like what music should the club come out to when they go on the pitch, or, you know, which of these third or fourth strips do you like best? I mean, they're not going to be like, you know...
And do these cost fortunes?
Well, that's the thing. They don't cost very much initially. But the idea is that they can be traded, that they go up and down. Listen, I think right now there's a lot of people out there who don't understand crypto.
Yeah.
And so they see this because it's so volatile. They see it as a scam. There's environmental concerns with Bitcoin mining. But this isn't Bitcoin. You know, blockchain and cryptocurrency are two different things. You can't educate yourself on this thing.
Well, enough people at home are like this. What is going on?
One of my concerns would be Socios have spent an enormous amount of money on marketing and doing these deals, which obviously, you know, if you watched Inter, like their sponsor was Inter Fan Token, right?
Yeah.
For me, I don't understand why you would buy this. Socios say that you buy this because, you know, these clubs are global brands. If you're in another part of the world and you want to feel part of it, other than watching the games on television and maybe, you know, buying a shirt online, this is another way you can do it. And you can vote on certain things. My point is, unless you're a Muppet, if I'm voting on irrelevant things, why would I do it? People have raised a specter of what they call pump and dump schemes and speculation and manipulating the prices of these tokens to rip fans off. I don't think it's that. I don't think we're at that stage. I don't think I've seen any evidence of it. It's new. I think this is the kind of thing that only works if people buy into it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm skeptical. But again, if you're a proud owner of a Socios Fan token at your club and you love your experience, reach out to us on social media. Reach out to me. I'd love to hear from you. Now, I don't think you're going to make top four, but I think we need to show some love to Wolves. And it's difficult for me to say because I have a major problem with the people who own the club.
Oh.
And obviously the fact that, you know, they also co-own GST Foot, which is run by George Mendes. However, they're playing very good football, much better football than they were playing last year. They didn't necessarily make any major signings in the summer. I mean, they brought in Huang and Trincao, but, you know, I don't think that's what moves the needle for them.
No.
So I think I got to give a lot of props and a lot of praise to Bruno Lage, who I think he's been really, really good.
I think he's been exceptional. I think he's gone under the radar. I think at the very start of the season, or certainly when he came in, there was signs where the XG for Wolves were quite high.
Oh, sorry. They also got a new goalkeeper to replace Rui Patricio, who's gone to Roma, and they got José Sá from Olympiacos.
Yeah. But
I don't need to guess who José Sá's agent is.
I watch Wolves, and I think best defensive record in the Premier League. So you see the amount of work that he's doing. That's time on the training ground. That's time on the grass. Max Kilman, I think, is in brilliant form. And then if you're going away from home or you want to dominate the ball and you think, right, what's a decent pair in midfield? And you look at Moutinho and Neves, both technicians who can handle the ball. And then Raul Jimenez is back. I think, like you said, Trincao's played his part. You know, they lost Jota. But I think Pedence has come in. This is all without Johnny. This is all without Neto as well. So you look at the work, I think, that the manager's doing. And I think he's believable as well. Sometimes you get a manager when they lose a game or they win a game. If they win a game, they're hyped and they're pumped. When they lose a game, ah, it's the player's fault, nothing to do with me. I don't get that with Bruno Lage. I don't get any waffle. I think I think what he says is really, really honest.
What I love when this guy speaks is that when you ask him football questions, he gives you football answers. He will explain stuff tactically, even just in post games, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because as you know, managers, I mean, football's a weird game, like the whole relation with football in the media, right? So we play, we in the media, well, the rights holders in the media, pay to have access to these managers after the game, who generally are only interesting if they have something that they want to say.
Exactly.
Otherwise, you know, they said like, oh, well, you know, when we tried hard and then we tried harder later and then the game got away from us a little bit, but I thought we were good value. You know, like,
no story.
Nothing there. No, it's just boring, right? Yeah. This guy gives you explanations. He tells you, well, and then Ait Nouri came a little, he was a little bit wider, he was able to deliver the ball, and Jimenez, and they reacted by moving, by making this substitution. I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. I like football. I like hearing football people talk about football.
Exactly.
So, yeah, he's breaking into my list of top 10 favorite Portuguese people.
I quite like him. And then talking of liking, I mean, what's not to like about Napoli Barca tonight? I mean, the best player of all time, in my humble opinion, Diego Maradona, will be watching down. What a game. But what, again, is happening to Barca? 1 minute they're good, next minute they're buying players but can't register them, they've got no money, they're talking about Haaland, they're talking about this, they're talking about that. Where are they at?
Well, we told you about this guy, Ferran Reverter, who was the club's CEO. He was kind of Joan Laporta's money man. We heard about him quitting. There were suggestions it might have had to do with the Spotify deal that he wasn't on board with. This guy is a very serious, very senior person at the club, who I think helped give Laporta a lot of credibility. He comes from a finance background, and the reason that's important is obviously Barcelona have an enormous amount of debt.
Yep.
So when you have an enormous amount of debt, you need finance people who know how to restructure it, know how to get the loans in. They did the deal with Goldman Sachs to relieve some of the pressure. But there's all sorts of stories swirling around. And they also involve Gerard Piqué. This is an old story that keeps coming back, that it was Gerard Piqué who allegedly told Laporta, now we don't need Messi back, helped usher him out the door. I've said all along, the Messi leaving story, there's more to it than what we know, because it's extraordinary. The guy cries when he leaves. I mean, why?
No, it's incredible.
So I think it's just more headaches for Laporta. And I think Reverter, I don't know the guy at all, but you have somebody who's on the inside who's now on the outside and who is a really passionate Barcelona fan. And that can be a slightly dangerous thing if you're Laporta or the club. Equally, Gerard Piqué hit back very angrily. A lot of allegations about him. Remember, he even published his his pay stub or his bank transfer thing. So it's a sensitive situation. It's more headaches for Xavi if stuff off the pitch affects you on the pitch.
For sure.
If you're a Barca fan, you hope they can buckle down, beeline for the top four. Europa League, just a bonus. Paris Saint-Germain midfielder Marco Verratti has bought an island in the metaverse. He plans to build a stadium there, maybe play the first top-flight game in the metaverse. Are you too old for this crap?
I don't even know what it is. What is it?
The metaverse?
Yes, what is it?
Honestly,
I mean, I've heard it mentioned, but I'm thinking, what is this?
It's a virtual environment, augmented 3D reality.
What's going on?
You might
on?
Have noticed Facebook. You probably still use Facebook. You're of that generation.
No, you pre-Facebook?
Okay. Facebook's now called Meta. No, it's the metaverse. It's Web 3.0. It's stuff that people are talking about. And you can buy things in the metaverse. He bought an island and he's going to build a stadium there. I think that's really cool. I think that's visionary from Marco Verratti.
Wow, that's blew my mind. That's too early for me on a Monday morning. Day is it? Don't know what day it is. Ha, Man City, what's happening to them? Issued some sort of order against the Chilean third division club. What's the story?
So I think this is kind of funny, kind of mysterious. So there's got to be something good behind it. So there's a third division club called Santiago City. In Santiago, in Chile, the capital of Chile. They're new. It's a newly formed club. They've joined a third flight. They have a social media presence. They have one of Bielsa's old assistants helping them. Manchester City feel that they're kind of trading on their name and their likeness. They feel their club badge looks suspiciously like Manchester City's.
All right.
And make it clear that they're not part of City Football Group, like New York City FC or Melbourne or whatever. I generally don't know. I invite everybody to go online, Google Santiago City. Santiago City's website has come down, but their Twitter account's still there. You can look at their crest.
I want to see the
look
badge.
Look at Man City's badge and tell me if one of these two is trying to be a little bit clever or if City are being mean-spirited and crushing entrepreneurship.
Wow.
And are they going to go after Leicester City next? That's the question. All right, that's all we got time for. But thanks so much for joining me, Don. I won't be here next week. I leave you in the capable hands of Julian Lawrence, who will no doubt return tanned from the slopes because I'm taking a holiday of my own. Until then, love the game, love your neighbor, love yourself.